I'm Ken Hemmings, and he is Chris Lang, and welcome to another of these regular property briefings. Again, a warm welcome to you, Chris.
As always, it's a pleasure to be with you.
I imagine when it comes to any type of investment, be it property, shares, or collectibles, you name it, there's always some risk involved. So how do you go about risk-proofing your commercial property investments?
Well, Ken, that's a pretty broad-ranging question you've asked there. And it seems quite simple, but there's a lot of facets to the answer. Maybe a place to start, and we're not going to have enough time to, I suspect today, to cover this in a lot of detail. But there's some housekeeping things you need to look at first, and that relates to getting the right vehicle for the purchase. And this comes down to asset protection. And it might be worth doing a podcast in a week or so specifically on that, rather than just the risk-proofing things we're talking about here. But having the right vehicle, because you've got to protect yourself from lawsuits, and it's not that you anticipate that's going to happen, but you've got to look or prepare yourself with the purchase vehicle to protect the assets that you've got, both the property you might be buying, but also any personal assets. And it comes down to estate planning and things like that as well. And obviously, there's things like insurance, and you can cover most risks as far as the physical side of the property is concerned by taking out the proper insurance. And again, maybe we ought to spend a bit more time on that specifically. But I think the purchase vehicle is important, getting advice at the very outset. And what I like to do with clients is when I take them into the solicitor that I would suggest using, they bring their tax partner in for the first 10-15 minutes of the meeting, and I have the client outline what it is that they are seeking to achieve with the purchase of this property, and going forward the next 10-15 years, how they see their investment and personal lives unfolding, so that then they can be given the best advice, so that rather than heading off in one direction and then 5-6 years later realizing the problem, and then someone says to you, well, if only you told me this is what you wanted to do, I would have suggested such and such. So it's better to address those issues now. Now, it may well be that what you as the purchaser have in mind doing is exactly the right thing. And I'm not suggesting it's a discussion to dissuade you from that. But if nothing else, it gives you confidence and confirmation that you are heading in the right direction. And as I said, it's getting that aspect sorted out from the outset.
Okay, you've decided upon the most suitable purchase vehicle for asset protection. What else should you be doing?
All right, well, it means that the next phase when you're starting out for an investment is to do the proper research. And this is both from a sales point of view and also from a rental point of view. And I'm assuming the property is already leased because, I mean, we're talking investors here rather than speculators or developers. So you need to research the area geographically as to what's happening, what are the trends in the area, but also to confirm the price being asked is appropriate and the property is not overlet. I mean, it may be underlet, and that's not necessarily a bad thing, because it means when you have the next market review, you're going to be able to achieve a significant increase in the rental. But it's those sort of aspects and rating the property, which is where that high return filter comes in. It enables you to quickly compare properties by giving them a rating on the 12 criteria that I've got. And that enables you to, with a single score at the end, work out what ought to go on your shortlist and what shouldn't. So that it's very much understanding the whole environment in which you're purchasing, both physical and economic environment, and making sure that you have made the proper assessment there. Now, we talk also about due diligence, and we've touched on that, I think, in a couple of podcasts so far, but that's something that is done after you have sorted out the commercial terms of the deal and you make a condition of the contract that during the settlement period that you have a time for a due diligence study, which may be anywhere from 7 business days to 21 business days, depending how the negotiations go, to undertake a verification of what has been presented to you. That's it's physical, it's legal, it's all sorts of aspects, and even within physical, it's, you know, it's the structure of the building, it's the services within the building. All those things are analysed, reviewed, and reported upon, so that you can make a decision as to whether you wish to continue with the contract or withdraw from the contract. So there's the research before, and there's the post contract research, if you like, which is the due diligence, which is done, as I said, after the contracts are exchanged, rather than running up meters beforehand, and then when you've done all your reports, go to try and negotiate the deal only to find that the property has been sold. So the idea is you put your foot on the property first, then you do the due diligence to verify what you have purchased is exactly what you thought you were purchasing.
It certainly makes sense to carry out detailed research and due diligence on the property's suitability. Is that mainly to ensure that you don't pay too much?
No, not really. The price ought to be established earlier, or the verification of the price. And as I think we've discussed in the past, the approach I use is to talk with a valuer who provides me with a figure up to which he is prepared to support. Now, my client may choose to pay more than that, but he knows that if he enters into a contract at that price or less, that the valuer will confirm the price paid as far as the financier is concerned. So in the absence of using an independent valuer, you just make sure you get the best advice going through. But, I mean, there are some times where, you know, I'm comfortable and the economics are there to actually pay a price higher than what the valuer will support. The problem is that if you've done your homework on borrowing, let's say, 70% of the purchase price and the valuer only values it at 10% less than what you paid, well, then you're going to be stretching yourself. Now, if you only wanted to borrow, say, 50% of the purchase price, that won't be a problem because then it might end up at 60% of the valuation. It's still 50% of the purchase price. So you've just got to understand the dynamics, the loan-to-value ratio, and how the property is going to be valued. And the reason I say that is because at the moment, there is a lot of money, particularly overseas, Asian money, looking for a home here in Australia, particularly Melbourne and Sydney. And as a result, they're driving the yields down. However, let's suppose we're looking at a property that the fundamentals suggest should be sold on a yield of, let's say, 7.75%. Now, there might be sales recently that have occurred because of this funds being flush in the economy for a commercial investment property where the yields have got down to 7.25%, maybe even 7%. So the valuer might say, well, look, I'd live with 7.5%. Now, the problem is that at the moment, you may not be able to get the sort of property looking for a yield higher than 7 or 7.25. So, in other words, you feel comfortable that you have bought in line with the current market, but the valuer, who's got to look longer term and understand, you know, if you're borrowing 3 to 5 years, the valuer has got to anticipate that in 3 years' time, the market may alter. The flush of funds that have come in may dissipate, therefore yields move back out to 7.5%. And he doesn't want to be caught short when the financier turns around and says, well, you know, you valued it on a low yield. You should have been aware of the artificially inflated prices, therefore lower yields caused by this overseas funds coming in, and made adjustments accordingly. So those are the sort of issues you've got to look at, and that's why I prefer to talk to a valuer and sort that out up front, even if it means that we have to let that property go that we're looking at, because it just doesn't scrub up as far as valuation for finance is concerned. Now, you know, I can only present that information to my client. If the client decides to accept and purchase a property at a 7.25% yield, they then do so with the full knowledge that a valuer may not value it at the same price, at the same figure as what they had paid on the contract. So those are the issues there. So that's not a due diligence thing. That's definitely a pre-contract discussion that you're having to get advice, either, if not by the valuer that's going to do the valuation, by someone who is pretty attuned to what a valuer would or most likely support.
Let's assume you settled on the property and now own it. What steps should you be taking to preserve and grow your investment?
Okay, well, we're talking about adding value here, and there's numerous ways in which you can do it. I think, have discussed this in part in the past. I mean, obviously, just dividing a larger parcel, either whether it's land or the building itself, into smaller parcels. And even if you have a strata titled floor, you can still subdivide that into two or more titles, notwithstanding that it is already a strata title. And it obviously works best if you've got a freestanding building, but there are simple ways you can overcome it otherwise. But just upgrading the premises, and that may not necessarily involve completely removing the tenant. It may be it's coming to the end of a lease that the tenancy needs recarpeting. While a tenant is required to maintain the interior of the building, as the landlord you may choose to paint the whole property out, recarpet, maybe do some modification of partitioning. There may be some additional pieces of equipment there. They may require a security system, you know, things like that. And in return, they will then pay you a higher rent. And so the idea being that for every dollar you spend, the increase in value is at least 2, probably 3 times that amount. So it's a matter of give and take with the tenant. So sometimes you're aware that when you purchase the property, that the tenant may not exercise their option at the end of their period. They might have had a 3-year lease with a 3-year option or a 5 plus 5. And then in the second period when you purchase it, so there's no guarantee they will continue, but they have to give you notice in advance as to what they're doing. So if you find out that they're not continuing on in their lease, and generally it's at least 3 months out, well, that gives you time to then gather together quotes to upgrade the premises. And it may be a significant upgrade, it may just be a trick up. But so it allows you, as soon as a tenant does vacate, to get the tradesman in, so that really, generally in a 2 to 4 week period, you can turn that around. And even while the renovations are going on, you can be marketing the property, or have your managing agent marketing the property to find another tenant. So that, and things like, particularly if you do have a reasonable lead time, an incoming tenant it has, you can then say as an incentive for the tenant, you make a decision, you can choose the colour of the carpet. I mean, you've decided upon the quality, but the colour of the carpet is not relevant as far as you're concerned, but it may be relevant for the tenant to fit in with the corporate colour scheme. So, you know, there are ways that you can add value, not overly expensively, and improve the quality and amenity of the property so that it attracts a disproportionately higher rent because it is now been moved from a, if it was a 5+5-year lease, a 10-year-old property into an up-to-date colour scheme. You might change the light switches on the walls if they're a bit old and dated. There's lots of little things you can do. You know, the taps on the sink in the toilet. You know, things like that that are not overly expensive, but it just makes someone, as they inspect the property, think that it's well maintained, up to date, and worthy of the rent that's being sought.
How do you know when it's the right time to sell?
Okay, this is always a perennial question. Look, it comes down to where you are in the cycle. And what I say to people when they buy the property is that you ought to have a mandatory 4-year review, and you have to justify the reason why you shouldn't sell the property. In other words, the motion on the table is that the property is going to be sold, and you have to justify why it shouldn't be. Now, as I said, it depends on where you are in the cycle, and the secret is to never try and pick the very top of the cycle. You might, from the point of view of selling, you might look at when you believe on advice what the top of the cycle is going to be, and then make your decision to sell at least 6 months, probably 9 to 12 months before that. Because at that point in the cycle, most people get carried away and believe it's going to go on forever. The reality is it's not. It's never going to keep rising forever. In the same way, when the market falls, it's never going to fall forever. It bottoms out and then will go up again. So don't get caught up in the hype. Now, okay, you missed out on 6 or 9 months growth, but you've already got, because you've held it for at least 4 years, that 4 years of capital growth going through, plus the rental and the increases in rental. So it's the 4-year review that you have. Now, the decision in 4 years might be that you're going to sell in another 12 months. So you actually might, and I'm not saying you have to sell it at that 4-year review. You just have to decide why you're going to hold it, and if you are going to hold it, when you're going to sell. Now, that in part comes around to when leases fall due. I mean, if in 4 years' time you've got a lease falling due in another 6 months, well, obviously what you're going to do is review or renew the lease, review the rent, and then that would be the time to sell the property, assuming the point in the cycle that you're at. Because sometimes the best way to make money is to sell at the top or near the top and then wait till the market comes down and then buy back in again. So same reason why you can't hold it through the peak and a trough, but you need a lease that's going to straddle that period when the market does decline. So just because the market's fallen doesn't, if you've got a good tenant and a good lease, doesn't concern you because you bought it as a long-term investment. So you've got to look at that. Now, the other thing is personal circumstances. And that's, again, part of the reason, the 4 years, because, you know, in 4 years' time, people get married, divorced, separated, sent overseas or whatever. And sometimes you get so consumed with the personal circumstances that you forget to look at your investments. And that's why, as I said, I try and make it a mandatory 4-year review so that you actually consciously make a decision to continue to own the property. And there's no reason why you won't continue, but it's just a discipline, if you like, to help you address and overcome and avoid any of those sort of risks that we talk about through just neglect. Because some people just have this buy, file and forget process when they buy a property and just put everything into a filing system and just let the meter keep ticking over and the rent coming in. That's fine, but it's not a really smart way to do it.
I think in an earlier podcast, you talked about some of the external issues, the hazards, if you like, which need to be avoided. But today was more about those strategic aspects you need to be aware of as a commercial property investor.
Yeah, well, you see, once you're aware of them and address them, they're not things you need to lose sleep over. In fact, that's why you pull together a close-knit group of consultants around you to give you the comfort and the freedom to focus upon your next opportunity.
Well, that's been great. Look, thanks, Chris.